Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hi there, OCD family community. It's November, which means it's time to kick off my third annual OC-related disorder series. Woo-woo. OCRDs get their rep for sharing, quote, common characteristics and overlapping features, end quote, so saith the International OCD Foundation. But they are different disorders with different functions, even when they share symptoms, which means different diagnoses requiring different treatments. So we're kicking off our journey through learning with body-focused repetitive behaviors, otherwise known as BFRBs. And I couldn't ask for better company to help us figure these out than today's guests, Dr. Marla Deibler and Dr. Renee Renardi. So stay tuned, fam, because there's greater understanding and an extra helping of hope coming right up.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family. The OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, family. All right. Hello. Hello. Welcome to, November already. Oh, in my corner of the world, that means it's officially that time of year where it's still dark out when we wake up for school or work in the morning. And that is not my favorite, to be honest. Nor is daylight savings time, which happens this weekend for the countries across the world that participate in such nonsense. Can you tell how I really feel? Maybe it's because I'm a mom. You know, I think there might be something to this. My kiddos never seem to get the memo. So we aren't really falling back so much as we're getting up even earlier / losing an extra hour of sleep. But hey, I'm sure a lot of people that are a lot smarter than me have an idea or two on why daylight savings time is a thing. So I'll just stay in my lane. Also, from my lane, I'll just acknowledge that there is a presidential election happening here in the US just a few days from now. And that has a good amount of anxiety fueling folks at present. But I just want to remind folks that this pod is about OCD and OCRDs. And there are a lot of places and spaces where people can go to process election business, but there are very few spaces where people can come get solid, empirically based support for the warriors and the families walking these roads. So you won't hear me comment or weigh in on current events really much at all, because I'm quite intentionally staying focused on our OCD family community. And for many of the fam not catching this steaming hot off the airwaves, I'm sure things have already happened. Feelings may be or continue to remain high. I get that. But again, there are a lot of places and spaces, to borrow from the P of our MAP discussion coming up later in the show, that can speak to those situations. My lane and our united lane here is for the loved ones, chosen family, warriors, and practitioners in this community. So if you're joining for this OCRD series and you're like, girl, you're not even talking a lick about politics or anything else, that's right. And that's very intentional, because this here is my lane. But speaking of licks, no pun intended, or maybe a little tiny bit of pun intended, that brings me back to today's topic, which is BFRBs. Now, BFRBs, otherwise known as body-focused repetitive behaviors, can present in many different ways. And chances are, if this topic is new to you, by the end of the episode, you'll be like, oh, actually, I can think of at least a couple people in my life that have had a relationship with BFRBs over the years. So what are they? Well, lucky for us, we have two phenomenal guests and authors of the BFRB Recovery Discovery Workbook here to share all about them today. So let me first introduce them to you, fam, and then we can all dive right into it. So first up, we have Dr. Marla Deibler, who is the founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia, otherwise known as CEH. And she's also a nationally recognized expert in anxiety and related disorders. Dr. Deibler serves as faculty for the Behavioral Therapy Training Institute through the International OCD Foundation, otherwise known as the BTTI. Marla also serves on the board of directors of OCD New Jersey, the New Jersey affiliate of the International OCD Foundation. She's a consultant at the New Jersey Center for Tourette's Syndrome and Associated Disorders, a visiting clinical supervisor at the Rutgers University Psychological Services Clinic, and a member of the Executive Council for the Association for Contextual Behavioral Sciences OCD Special Interest Group. She's the co-author of the BFRB Recovery Workbook, a step-by-step guide to effective recovery from hair pulling, skin picking, nail biting, and other body-focused repetitive behaviors. And then last but not least, we are also joined today by Dr. Renee Rinardi. Dr. Rinardi is a licensed psychologist and director of the Lakeside Center for Behavioral Change. Beyond that, Renee specializes in the treatment of body-focused repetitive behaviors, OCD, hoarding disorder, tic disorders, and related conditions. She is the co-author of the BFRB Recovery Workbook that I just mentioned, and she is the program developer of CourageCritters.com, a skills-focused online and plush animal system. Renee also serves as part of the BTTI faculty for the International OCD Foundation, and she is an advocate for childhood mental health and a delegate to the United Nations CSW. I mean, you two are pretty fancy. So, fam, as you can hear, our esteemed and knowledgeable guests know a thing or two about a thing or two, which led them to expanding BFRB treatment, and we all get to benefit from that. So let's get to chatting. Welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and I am thrilled today because, first of all, I have to say, doing the OCRD series is one of my favorite things that I do every year because it's so, so important. And you'll learn very quickly, family, that these disorders are all their own animal. And so today we're talking about body-focused repetitive behaviors, and we're in for a treat because we have two of the premier experts on body-focused repetitive behaviors. We have Dr. Marla Deibler, and we also have Dr. Renee Rinardi. So welcome to the show, ladies. So happy to have you here with the fam.
Thanks, Nicole. It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. If you guys are open to it, would love for you to share how you got into treating BFRBs. Again, BFRB stands for body-focused repetitive behaviors. And maybe, Marla, if you would be up for starting us off.
Sure. So our histories are largely the same, actually. So early on in our training, in our doctoral programs, we wound up training at a site that specialized in OCD and BFRBs before they were called BFRBs. And so we were exposed to a lot of different patients struggling with these behaviors at a time when individuals really didn't have many places to turn for good informed treatment. And coming into contact with the community who were struggling with these behaviors was really impactful because their connection with one another was just so incredibly moving as a therapist to see them transform over connecting with one another, removing the secrecy, losing the shame, and being able to learn a little bit of self-acceptance and self-compassion. And so I was hooked.
Yeah. Well, and you know what's funny, Marla, is when you say those things, even if we take the BFRB part out of it, how helpful would it be for any of us to have less shame around things, more self-compassion and acceptance and empowerment? So I love that. So then if I'm understanding correctly, Renee, you guys, were you in the same doctoral program at around the same time?
Yes, we were. Marla and I go back to 1998 together. So our doctoral program, which was an integrative psychotherapy training model, which was fantastic. And we trained at the same site, focusing on OCD, BFRBs, Tourette's, related conditions. And so we're really, really fortunate to have the integrative training and the early exposure to BFRBs and related conditions. And I would just echo what Marla was saying about when we really got hooked on treating BFRBs, it was attending conferences and retreats held by Christina Pearson, who's just a phenomenal human being and really brought the heart of this community together and brought in professionals
to really demand better treatment
and even to identify
and treat these conditions. So it was fun to be early on in the development of BFRB treatment.
I love that. It is really fascinating. And family, if you've been to any recent conferences, such as the International OCD Conference, I know that I saw Renee and Marla presenting on BFRBs there. And they actually just this past weekend were doing an intensive training on BFRBs. And so they are very busy. They've written a fantastic workbook that some of our listeners may be aware of. If not, don't worry. We're going to talk all about that, called the BFRB Recovery Workbook. But first, before we get all the way over to our resources, let's talk about what are BFRBs? Because again, you guys were on the earlier side of it, but that doesn't mean it's just a new phenomenon. It was just discovered. We started to understand that there was a connection and that there was deeper understanding. And conversely, there's hope then, now that we know what we're dealing with. And so can we describe for family members listening, what are BFRBs? And I know that's a big, broad question.
Well, the big, broad answer. BFRBs, or body-focused repetitive behaviors, are self-grooming behaviors that involve any kind of biting, picking, pulling, scraping hair, skin, or nails, or part of the body that results in damage, essentially. And so that includes things like hair pulling or trichotillomania, skin picking or excoriation disorder, nail biting, and other kinds of behaviors like cheek biting, lip biting, nose picking, and a host of other kinds of repetitive behaviors like those.
Yeah, excellent. And so a lot of people listening may go, oh, well, you know, I've done nail biting or maybe nail tearing or picked at a scab or whatever the thing is. So what distinguishes maybe just the occasional behavior from something like a BFRB where we're getting into that disordered category?
It's a great question. And when we look at BFRBs, there is a difference, right, between self-grooming, which occurs since the beginning of time. And there's documentation about that going back to 640 BCE, documented cases of people engaged in hair pulling, skin picking. And even before then, I think as long as humans have existed, these behaviors have existed. And grooming plays a really important function in our society, to our self-care. And it's, by the way, it's not just unique to humans. Birds, dogs, cats, horses, even fish engage in repetitive grooming behaviors. And under certain conditions, we can see those behaviors become excessive. And where it becomes a clinical condition is where people really struggle to stop and is causing significant damage to the body or damage to emotions, relationships, their ability to focus on other tasks. That's when it crosses the line into a diagnostic condition for individuals. And when we look at prevalence rates, you know, we know that to clinical levels, depending on the BFRBs, it's about 1 to 6% of the population. That's internationally. Those prevalence rates tend to hold about true is what we're finding. Research out of Italy and Israel and Turkey kind of support that as well. But subclinical, kind of to your point, in more recent research, and I think just by talking to people, we find that those subclinical levels are about 60%.
Wow, 60%. And so that just really paints a picture of how common. That's more than half. That's more than just the probability out of flipping a coin here. It is fairly common. And again, like you said, even if we think about this through kind of cultural context, et cetera, there can be different grooming behaviors. And again, we're not pathologizing grooming behaviors. But if a grooming behavior, self-grooming behavior, enters into a distressing zone where it feels like, I don't feel like I have control over this. This may impact my ability to go to social outings because we're going to the beach this weekend. It's like winter time, but I used to live in California, go to the beach in November. And maybe I don't want to go because I've been picking at different spots, or I may feel some resistance to exposing myself, exposing my body, people potentially seeing some of these behaviors that I've done. And so we can see how it starts to impact, say, social functioning, or whether it's work functioning, home functioning. And so it tends to be something, and I don't know about you guys, if most of your referrals come in as pediatrics, but I feel like a lot of times I will see referrals come in pediatrics because the parents are really aware of these different behaviors, and it's also causing distress within the family unit. And that's not to say, if you're listening, that adults don't have this, but adults have a little more industry in terms of whether they decide to go in for treatment or not. And parents are often very quick to resolve or try to fix a situation. They say, oh, well, you're having trouble with hair pulling and you have a spot missing now, so I'm going to take you into somebody so that you stop doing that. That can be a very common looking referral, and that's one of many, many examples. And so when we think about BFRBs, and I did attend your chat at the conference this year, you were talking about how BFRBs are very complex because it's not just about the urge or the signaling, and it's not just about the response, but it really is a culmination of signals and responses. And I would love if you could help explain to the family listening what is meant by that.
So that is what we like to think about this as, right? The BFRB is sort of a signal that something is uncomfortable, right? That an individual is trying to deal with something that is difficult to deal with, right? It's a coping response. So it's both a signal that something is kind of out of balance, and it's a response to that in an effort to try to make it better, right? To try to fix it, because who doesn't want to feel more comfortable? So we think about it in terms of the model of psychological flexibility as kind of our underlying foundation for how we conceptualize the problem. In other words, we like to think of it as there is some internal discomfort, like a thought, like an image, like a memory, like an emotion, like a sensation or an urge, right? Those internal private experiences that show up on the inside spontaneously for all of us. And then we respond to those signals, right? If there's an uncomfortable emotion like anxiety or like fatigue or a thought like, I don't like the way that these uneven hairs look or this gray hair has got to go, right? Those discomforts internally are met with a response. We can do a lot of different things in response to that or choose not to do something in response to that. And one of the responses could potentially be carrying out the body-focused repetitive behavior, right? To try to push away those discomforts, to get rid of them, to make it feel better, essentially. And in the short term, that provides relief. And for some people, even it feels good in that short term. But in the long term, it creates consequences that are unwanted, like emotion dysregulation, like self-criticism, like doubt, like shame, like frustration and anger. And unfortunately, those consequences can also serve as further fodder for the BFRB, because those are more internal discomforts that are difficult to sit with and to manage effectively for those individuals that have learned this problematic pattern.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I recall, and I think it was, and we use kind of this imagery in the therapy world quite a bit, but I think because it's so helpful, I want to say there was a slide that you guys shared. And if you guys would happen to have this and would be okay with me sharing it on this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com, I think it was a glacier. And it was like, okay, so here's the tip of the iceberg. And I think that's, we're used to that idea. But there's so much under the glacier. And as you were describing those different points, I was going, I think that image really kind of helps show the magnitude of the complexity that's happening underneath the water. Am I correct? Was it a glacier picture? Okay.
You are correct, Nicole. And actually, it's one of those things, whenever people talk about body-focused repetitive behaviors, hair pulling as a habit, or skin picking as a habit, or nail biting, or cheek biting, or lip biting as a habit, I cringe a little bit, because habit is something that people think of as a simplistic behavior. But as you mentioned, yeah, we see the behavior, and that's what's sticking out on top, right? On top of the water, the tip of the iceberg. But there's so much going on underneath, and so many variables that we have to assess for. And we'll talk about what to look for in a functional behavioral analysis. But we want to look at some of those signaling and responses that are happening. And oftentimes it can be emotions like stress and sadness and anxiety, like shame, embarrassment, a lot of things that come up. So we'll talk about the thoughts involved with that. We'll talk about the emotions, the sensations. BFRB might start with an itch, right? Or a pokiness or a roughness of the skin. So we want to look at those things. Emotional vulnerability factors, sleep, exercise, nutrition, cultural factors. Marla and I wrote an article this year
on the importance of understanding BFRBs in the cultural context. And that isn't something that should be ignored either. There's so many things involved with awareness and willingness and readiness and distress and tolerance and emotional regulation. You know, so many things to adequately treat BFRBs. That's why an integrative model is so necessary, because these are not just simple habits. And most people have tried many times to control or decrease these behaviors on their own, and they just find that they're falling short. They don't have the skills that they need to effectively manage or feel, even understand their own behavior.
Yeah. And as you were describing that, it made me think of, we've talked about BFRBs here on the show a couple different times in the past. And the model that we used at that time, Combi, would talk about the SCAMP. And you were talking about the emotional and the cognitive pieces, sensory pieces. That reminds me a lot of what I've learned about the SCAMP. And so you guys have a little bit of a different approach in terms of how you break down BFRBs. And family, you might hear some overlap and go, oh, those are things, though, that we're trying to figure out when we're, because they do play a big part. It's not just a one button issue. There's lots of different facets and layers to this. And so can you guys help describe the approach that you take to break that down? And that might be a big question that we could take for the rest of the show, but we'd love to hear more about that.
So we try to, as I said, in the context of the psychological flexibility model, we help people to understand, of course, the antecedents, the behaviors, and the consequences more broadly. But specifically, we're looking at first, like, what sets the stage? What is the vulnerability that sets the stage to those internal discomforts? What makes it more likely that the BFRB is essentially going to show up to begin with? And there are things that range very greatly that people have varying degrees of control over, right? There are genetic variables, there are hormonal variables, there are sleep variables, nutrition variables, exercise, how we might use substances, or whether we have or struggle with addictions. There are medical conditions that can interact with BFRBs. There are acute and chronic stressors in our life, right? Like the diathesis stress model. We have more going on in our lives. We tend to sometimes see more BFRB symptoms. There are like the tendency toward a low emotional stimuli threshold. Some individuals are just a little bit more sensitive to being triggered emotionally. And then their reactions to those triggers are a little bit bigger. So being a little bit more emotionally sensitive. And then there are, of course, co-occurring mental conditions, which are very common with BFRB. So all of that in consideration has to be examined. What are these underlying vulnerabilities? And then we like to look at the context in which people are more likely immediately to experience those internal discomforts. We call that the MAP. The MAP is what sets the stage for, or the path to, those internal discomforts. So what does that path look like? Like movement and automaticity, how our body is positioned, how we are moving our bodies, and how aware we are of the behavior and where our bodies are in space. Whether or not this is an automatic sort of behavior that is engaged in with low awareness or no awareness, or whether we're fully aware and it's a goal-directed behavior. We look at those awareness is the A of vulnerabilities, right? How aware are we of the vulnerabilities that set the stage? If I didn't sleep well, I'm probably going to be a little bit more vulnerable the next day, right? When we don't sleep well, we tend to be a little bit at a disadvantage when it comes to all sorts of different kinds of struggles, including BFRBs.
Yeah.
And then the P is people, places, and spaces. Who and what are in our environment? Because that can be a significant consideration in terms of the factors that make it more likely that those discomforts are going to show up. And then we look at the discomforts. So the discomforts, we use the acronym TIMES. So TIMES are things like thoughts, images, memories, emotions, and sensations and urges. The stuff that kind of shows up internally in our minds and in our bodies that we may or may not respond to in a way that's adaptive or maladaptive. So we look at all of those things in order to determine what is more likely to lead to a BFRB and what isn't, and the way in which an individual then experiences and carries out the BFRB and what the consequences of that are both in the short term and in the long term, because how one experiences that over time can change. Like I said, initially, it can feel good and satisfying, and it serves a function, right? These behaviors serve a function. But in the long term, typically experienced as negative and unwanted, and that reinforces the cycle.
Yeah, and it's such an important distinction, because for any family that is used to tuning in around OCD, one of the things we talk about with OCD is how it is ego dystonic. And if you're newer and joining us and you're like, well, what does that mean? I mean, it's a fun word, first of all. Throw that out at a party. They're going to be like, what? But ego dystonic, my kind of short and oversimplified definition is it's really distant from who you see yourself to be or believe yourself to be. It's not who you want to be. Ego dystonic. On the flip side, when something's more in line with your values, it's more congruent. It's more in sync. I think of the old boy band because that's just my cultural context. But when something is in sync with your values, it's egocentric. And when we're talking about something like body-focused repetitive behaviors, we're talking about something that is more in sync with your values. Because if you think about it, you just described really well, Marla, like when we're feeling distressed and all these different factors, I'm sure there were so many family members going, yeah, I mean, that's how I function probably in life, period, right? I'm more uncomfortable in this setting if I'm around people that are bringing that tone and that vibe. And in certain spaces, certain environments are going to be more stressful, maybe at work, maybe in a social setting. There can be a lot, you know, for our neurodivergent population that can feel like I have to fit into a mold that doesn't feel like a natural process to me. And that brings about more distress. So I feel better if I'm at home, but if I'm at maybe work or a social function, I feel that pressure to mask, and that can be difficult. And so we can see how what is in sync with our values is managing that discomfort. And with BFRBs, there is that urging that in and of itself can feel uncomfortable. And so it can start off so like understandably in the way of just trying to bring some soothing or comfort to oneself. And then it can grow into this bigger thing where you could go, yeah, it does bring comfort in the time. But then maybe after the fact, when I look around or I'm missing a spot of hair or I don't have any more eyelashes or whatever the thing is, now I'm feeling some distress about it. And so that distress brings more discomfort. And what does discomfort do? It can bring more urge. And that is one of many examples. It's not to say that it's just about discomfort. Sometimes it could be boredom. Sometimes it could be excitement. It could be so many different things. But we can see how it is more egocentric, right?
And I think it's so important to look at the multifaceted nature behind BFRBs. BFRBs are complex. And they're also heterogeneous. So it really varies between individuals and even within the same individual. That's why, you know, over time, so since the 1970s, when we look at the evolution of BFRB treatments, when we look at older treatment models like habit reversal training or COM, actually, Marla and I were both involved in COM research 25 years ago, just doing interviews, collecting data, fitting it into the SCAMP model. So those are great models. And as like most treatments, as it evolves, we start to look at what's working and what else do we need? And for some people, they find that a more simplistic treatment approach works. So they can get their sensory needs met or just modify their environment a little bit with stimulus control. And that works for them. But that wasn't enough for everybody. And that's where we started to see things like ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, looking more at values and the relationship that one has with themselves, with others, with their BFRB. We started to look at research being done on DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, and how useful that can be for people with body-focused repetitive behaviors, being able to regulate emotions, tolerate distress. And actually, and to your point earlier, Nicole, yes, a lot of times BFRBs do start in childhood and early adolescence. And so learning these types of skills is so important. I mean, that's a big time of life. And if you're built sensitive, and a lot of people with BFRBs are, they're feeling these big emotions.
they're trying to self-regulate in whatever way. And when we don't have anything else yet, because we're relatively new to the world as children and adolescents, we haven't learned those things. And if we don't, we grow up to be adults too, where our BFRB becomes, you know, our friend that offers us maybe not the best advice, but it becomes a major way to cope with our world. And we see this in animals too, especially zoo animals engaged in fur plucking behaviors and all kinds of things. I had a cat growing up that I adopted, and it had fur missing on both sides of its body because of the stressful life that it had before coming to my home. And so it's something that there's so many things involved with BFRBs. And I think that's why we've seen the evolution into a more integrative treatment, starting with more behavioral and traditional models of treatment, more traditional CBT. As time has gone, integrating in more ACT, more dialectical behavioral therapy, looking at interpersonal skills, right? The impact that BFRBs have on people's lives, their friendships, marriages, their relationships with coworkers. All of these things are so important. The aspect of shame. You know, there's, again, that iceberg. There's so many things. And that's where we've seen more movement toward integration. Now we're also looking at technology-assisted treatments too and how that can be useful, using strategies to help people become more aware, making treatment more accessible to people. So that's why Dr. Deibler and I almost every week are giving a training somewhere to talk about these things, to let people know that, hey, you're not alone and there is treatment available and these things are difficult to manage on your own.
Yeah, it's a great point. And again, family, I'm going to have links to all the information with Dr. Deibler and Dr. Rinardi over on this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. And so even if you find this episode well after it published, there is a good chance they are still doing the work out there and they're still training. So if you are a clinician or maybe you are a family member and you're going, oh my gosh, is there still work being done? I would anticipate yes and. Moving forward, it's only going to continue to grow from here. But one of the things, as you were describing the process, and I think something that probably a lot of listeners can relate to, is something like emotional eating. And I was thinking about how the process and the function, and maybe if you guys could speak to it more, it's very similar, right? You know, where you could go, there might be different reasons why I might turn to something like food for comfort, or it could be boredom, or it could be excitement, or it could be a lot of different things. But at the same time, there can be a lot of complexity, shame, frustration, disappointment, following a coping mechanism of that sort. And so can you describe, because I think a lot of people understand that as more than just a habit. Some people might go, yes, I might have a habit of emotional eating. But the reason, the function of it feels more similar to how BFRBs can function. And I could be wrong about that, but it just made me think. So I'm curious what you ladies think on that.
Yeah, Nicole, I think you're spot on. I would absolutely agree. I think you can think about this model as being sort of transdiagnostic, really, for any behavioral struggle, because we're looking at it from a broad view, right, of like a problematic or unwanted behavior that isn't ultimately serving you well. How do you address the why am I engaging in this, right? What is the function? What's the context like in which I'm more likely to engage in the behaviors? And what do I do to develop skills so that I can do something different? It's not that I'm not trying hard enough, as we often tell people, right? It's not that you haven't tried hard enough to change this. It's that perhaps you haven't tried the right thing. Perhaps you're looking in the wrong places for the answer to what this is. And so, yes, I use that as an example all the time, actually, is like problematic eating. Sometimes that sleeve of cookies feels good, or that extra piece of pizza at a party serves us in some social context, maybe makes us feel a little bit better or gives us something to do with our hands so that we don't feel as awkward in social settings if we're a little bit socially anxious, right? Or having a drink for that matter can serve the same kinds of function. So yes, I mean, I think that's the case. And I would add too that I think as the field of psychotherapies has kind of gone on, especially the idea of these evidence-based protocols, and I'm all for manualized treatments. I think they're fantastic and I largely practice them. If we think about it though, being able to provide therapy in a flexible manner because everyone's individual life and needs and the context in which those symptoms show up are very different. We have to individualize treatment. thinking about the biopsychosocial model and the way that we initially learned in our graduate program to conceptualize treatment and to tailor treatment to the individual, I think sometimes we get lost in the step-by-step, this is what you do in session one, this is what you do in session two, this is what you do in session three. Instead of thinking kind of flexibly about what do I need to do to fully understand this person and the struggle that they're coming to be with, and how do I then tailor with those manualized treatments in mind and understanding what these conditions are like, how do I bring those skills to them in a way that's going to be helpful for them as an individual?
Yeah, really great point. Since I'm looking at my notes from this past summer, because I was sitting in on Marla and Renee's talk, and to this end, I have this little asterisk here next to my individualized guide, different steps. There was really a stair step that you presented, and it was a four part, but again, don't get too caught on the four parts. It was kind of these different stages of treatment, which left room for the person and the unique and complex and changing nature of how the BFRB is functioning. This is a huge key word if you've heard anything. The function of the behavior, function of the stimulus, function of the response even. And so in those four stair steps, and something you were describing earlier, Marla, just as you were talking more broadly about the treatment, it looks like we have the first step is really just building a better self-understanding about what's going on with the BFRB and how it's functioning for you. And then we have step two, and that was talking about narrowing down that map, which was that acronym that you described before that dealt with different aspects. I just remember the P, the places, people, places. That's what's sticking out in my mind. But the map. And so again, these could be a couple sessions. These could be months of treatment. This could be our brains are going to click with different information in different ways. It might be something that we have to revisit, just like going up the stairs. Oh, I forgot something. I'm going to go back down, grab this and come back up the stairs, right? And step three being the times, and times being, again, one of the acronyms you just explained really well, Marla. And then that leads us to kind of the ultimate platform of being able to thrive with BFRBs. And so in terms of treatment then, how and when, especially for people listening, maybe they have a kiddo or maybe they have a partner that is struggling with the glacier here. How and when does one decide to pursue treatment for BFRB?
Well, it depends on why people are coming in. And if we're lucky enough to work with people who are children and adolescents, we can really focus on that skills development, talking about how they view their BFRB and also what their expectations for treatment are. So many people come in and we ask, what do you hope to work on in therapy? And they'll say, stop picking or stop pulling. These are our behaviors that tend to be chronic. That doesn't mean a life of suffering. It means that this is something that tends to occur for people, and it waxes and wanes throughout one's life, depending on what those antecedents are, depending on what's going on in life, what's going on hormonally, what's going on in your relationships, what's going on as far as your life stressors. And so you're absolutely right. We want to teach people how to understand the function of their BFRB and how to learn what that message is. So the example I oftentimes use is think of the BFRB to kind of follow up on the eating example, that noticing that our stomach is growling. Well, how do we respond to that? With a BFRB, it's kind of like eating a ooey gooey chocolate brownie. It tastes really good in that moment, but we're not actually fixing the problem. We're not actually giving our body what it needs. And so we have to learn some skills. We have to learn that signal and understand that. And we know what our stomach growling means, but we don't always notice what that means when our BFRB is knocking on our door asking for attention.
Yeah.
And then we want to be able to offer alternatives. Yeah, the brownie is delicious, but it's not really giving us the nutrients that we really need to heal. And so that's where we have to say, thanks, but no thanks. I think I'll try this over here instead. The chicken and broccoli, which may doesn't feel as exciting in the moment, but long-term is going to feel better and therefore tend to decrease our hunger more and more over time. And so that's what we want to focus on. But the first step, kind of like you were talking about, Nicole, with these steps, the first step is building that self-understanding, doing that self-observation, because everybody is different. We can't just go on a social media site and be like, oh, that worked for you. I better try that. It might or might not work for you, depending on that function, what your BFRB is trying to tell you that you need or that your child needs or that your loved one friend might need.
So we have to start with those self-observation skills.
And that's really step one through behavioral monitoring. There's a lot of ways to do that.
And I'm gonna, what else does fam do? We call each other out, right? So I'm gonna call them out. And I, as a parent, have done this too in terms of going, I can help with that. I can go in, if the metaphor is don't eat the ooey gooey brownie and have some chicken and broccoli, I can go in and tell my kid, like, no, don't do this. This is going to lead to bad things for you. You're going to have a sugar crash. Hopefully we're not weight shaming or anything like that. But, you know, a lot of parents come in and they see and they go, oh, yeah, I know you shouldn't do the ooey gooey brownie. So for the BFRB, the person, maybe they're picking or maybe they're cheek pulling or they're lip biting. And the parent comes in and they're like, no. Don't do that. Chicken and broccoli, people. Chicken and broccoli. A lot of parents go, well, I do. I'm on my kid about that. I'm on my partner about that. I'm sure that lands super well with your partner, too. But what would you say to that? Because there is a natural, I think, instinct for people to try and intervene when they're like, I can see this train wreck coming. I'm going to help. But when it comes to BFRBs, sometimes the best of intentions aren't helpful. And this is part of what we learn in treatment. And so what would you say to kind of that scenario and how a therapist that understands BFRBs could be a great ally in this process?
Yeah, I mean, I think you really make a good point about parenthood, right? Parenthood is difficult and it's messy and there's no manual. And we've all done things that we later say, oh, maybe that wasn't the best way to approach that. And even those of us that see kids in therapy and families in therapy every day. I mean, I think you're right that as parents, we have the best intentions in mind. We're trying to protect our kids from having negative experiences. We're trying to protect them from pain in a way that perhaps they're not able to see quite yet. But that sense of over control, and I use that, you know, sensitively because we all do it. This is not blamey at all, right? We're trying to protect our kids and prevent harm. But in the end, it doesn't allow them the freedom to have control in order to be able to develop skills that ultimately they're going to need in life. It's like if I notice that my kid is not socializing well, I can teach them how maybe to interact and give them some communication skills, suggestions about how they might make a friend in a classroom or at an activity outside of school, right? But if I go and I go up to the kids or go up to the parents and make arrangements, which is appropriate developmentally early, right? Like 6, 7 years old, you might be doing that as a parent. But if I start doing that at 13, 14, when my kid is not doing those things yet, well, that I'm not giving them the ability to develop those skills well, and they might struggle. And that's okay, because that struggle will lead, hopefully, to skills development and resilience and grit and all that stuff that we want our kids to be able to have. So we kind of have to be able to sit with our own discomfort as parents in watching our kids struggle a little bit, give them resources, give them the ability to develop those skills, and then kind of stand back and watch and be there for them if they need as they work through trying to manage these things themselves.
Yeah. And so you're speaking to really that parallel process of the kid is trying to figure something out and you're like, I could help fix this, but then they're not necessarily learning how to fix or manage is probably the better word, because we would love some magic wands in this world. But generally, it's a better word probably to use there is manage it. And so it's really hard because if you go in and you see your kid is pulling at maybe a spot that is already balding and they're feeling distress with their friend group about it and trying to cover it, and you're feeling distress about, oh my gosh, what are people going to think about my kid that is sitting here pulling their hair out? Plus, I don't want them to get bullied by the other kids at school. And you come in and think, okay, so I've got to manage my distress. It's kind of hard sometimes for parents to go, but why wouldn't I just be like, stop doing that. Remember, you don't want this negative attention. You always feel worse about this later. Do something else. Don't do that. Or have even maybe a consequence sometimes driven out of an intention to try and help extinguish a behavior. But part of what's tricky here is this behavior, just like eating. We don't stop eating, period, right? We can't just extinguish a behavior. And that's really hard because some people in the family may not struggle with hair pulling at all. And so they're like, yes, you can. None of the rest of us do it. You cannot do this. And it's not that simple,
right?
But often, too, we see that genetic connection, right? That hair pulling might not be your thing, but there's a good chance environmentally and genetically that there are some factors that maybe you struggle with your own thing that can function in a similar way to the BFRB, right?
Absolutely. And I think that, to your point, parents oftentimes, we use the skills that we have at the time,
right?
And we want to motivate our children to do what we see to be the right thing for them because we're afraid of that harm. Like Marilla was saying too, we want to prevent them from experiencing things. But I think that it's important to approach things with curiosity and compassion. And like you said, Nicole, a lot of times BFRBs, they have a genetic component. So it's not unusual, actually, to see BFRBs in a family. So not always there, but it's often there. And we'll talk about it. And it's not unusual if I'm working with a child who's brought in for treatment for, let's say, trichotillomania. And then we talk about all the BFRBs. And then the parent's like, oh, wait a second. I have difficulties with skin picking, or I bit my fingernails as a child. And we can see that. The other thing, too, when we talk about genetics, family members, sometimes when they don't have that immediate within the parents or direct siblings, people are like, well, we don't know anybody in our family. I'm like, well, how many people outside of your family know about your BFRB? They'll be like, well, no one, right? Because of the shame. I'm like, well, that's where, you know, we don't always know if we have a cousin or an aunt or something because there's so much shame and stigma involved with BFRBs that we don't always know what that family connection is. But we do tend to see that genetic component. And so I always encourage parents to understand that, yes, absolutely, like Marla was saying, this is skills development. Their BFRB is like knocking on their door, telling them that they need something. So when we tell them to just stop, it's kind of like a baby with a wet diaper or a hungry baby telling them to just stop crying. No, there's an underlying need there. And that's what we have to approach with that curiosity and compassion, is to learn what is that need. Because to just say, knock it off or stop or look at your second grade picture and how nice your eyelashes look there, right? Those things, while intending to motivate a child, all they have is the chocolate brownie. They don't know how else to care for their needs in that moment. And we don't even know sometimes what those needs are. That's what we have to explore. So when we notice our child or notice ourselves engaged in a BFRB, it's taking that wait, watch, and wonder type of approach to be able to be like, okay, I wonder what's going on here. Let's gather some data. Let's do some self-observation. I wonder what your body's trying to tell you right now, right? Let's continue to observe that. And that's what's actually going to be useful. Let's try to decode that message of your BFRB and really give you what you need, which then makes it easier to say no to that chicken and broccoli. Maybe we're low on vitamin C and we need citrus fruit, right? But we're not going to know that all the time. We're just trying to fill that void, whatever that void is. And that's what we do as humans, all of us.
Yeah, and I like the example of the cry too, because it's one of those things where, you know, as a mom, and I can remember different cries of my children over time, but crying was communicating something. And sometimes it was, I'm wet. Sometimes it was dirty. Sometimes it was, I'm gassy. Sometimes it was, I miss you. You know, cry could mean so many different things. And what you're speaking to, again, when you were talking about the nature of BFRBs, is there can be many different reasons, right? It can be a form of communication, something signaling and a response to try and kind of help regulate, self-regulation, that response. And so for the scenario, say we have a six-year-old, okay, and parent walks in and kiddo's pulling at, we'll pick hair pulling for this one. Part of the reason where we would advocate for bringing in somebody for treatment, again, earlier Marla was saying for this younger kid, we may need to have a little more of a concrete structure. They may not have a bigger understanding, but we hope in time this will build skill development. But let's say we have a six-year-old, we come in, kid's picking, you're feeling dysregulated as a parent. First of all, everyone's going to be like, well, so what am I supposed to do? Just be like, keep it. Yeah, or not say something, and it gets murky because there's not necessarily one way to respond, because again, it depends on what's going on for that individual kiddo. But where do we see the utility then of partnering with a therapist that can help translate the complexity of that kind of situation and how to handle it based on where maybe that child is in treatment? Can you speak to that process a little bit?
I think it's so very different for different kids. And so it's really important to kind of look at the family relationships and the way in which they communicate around BFRBs. Like sometimes we might see a 12-year-old who comes in because the parent brings them in, the parent is distraught, doesn't know what to do. This kid is picking or pulling or biting and they are asking them to stop. And the kid is just frustrated and wants to be left alone. Like, stop bringing it up. I don't want you to bother me about this, right? They feel like they're being nagged. They feel like they're being blamed and shamed. And in that case, it might be helpful to have a totally hands-off approach to say that when you bring it to their attention, it's actually having a paradoxical effect, right? It's making them more dysregulated, and it might actually be contributing to the reinforcement of their BFRB, right? Because this is maybe the function of the behavior, is to manage the way in which they're responding to the parents nagging. It might help perpetuate the cycle. But then there are other times, and that might be working together, right? That might be, let's just do an experiment. This week, let's try to just ignore it entirely. Let's not bring it up at all and see how the week goes. Like, give the kid a little space to be able to kind of try to manage this and see if anything looks a little different in terms of how they're experiencing their BFRB. Let's just see. Let's observe. But then there might be other kids for which the kid is like, you know what? It doesn't help me when you say, did you pull today or did you pick today or did you bite today or how's that regrowth going? Sometimes that might not be helpful, but the kid might say, you know what, though? Sometimes I engage in this behavior, I don't even realize it. And it's not helpful when you bring it up that way. But you know what? It might actually be helpful to have you bring it to my attention in a more subtle, non-judgmental way. So then we might have to have a conversation about, okay, what might that look like? It might be a gentle, kind of subtle, nonverbal gesture, like putting the parent's hand on the child's shoulder when they notice them picking or pulling, right? It might be handing them a tool that they might prefer to use when they notice them picking or pulling. It might be something else, right? It might be coming up with a code word totally unrelated to the BFRB, right? Like elephant or magic or something like that, that can serve as just a kind of subtle cue that I'm noticing this. If the child feels like that would be helpful to cue them to sort of do some of that introspection. Okay, what's happening? What do I need to do for myself here?
Yeah, and that brings up a really good point. And we've talked about this here on the show before too, is that BFRBs are sometimes, we're very aware of when we're engaging. And at other times, there's an unawareness that can happen where maybe you're just sitting watching TV and your hand touches your arm or touches your scalp and you feel something and you start working on a spot and you realize, oh my gosh, I didn't consciously go into that. It just was like a natural response to feeling it. And so there can be some differences in how people engage in BFRB, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. It's kind of like, again, not to beat this analogy into the ground here, but people that maybe mindlessly eat and before they know it, the bag's gone versus people that are very intentionally going and grabbing a certain portion and going into it with the intention of, I'm going to eat this amount, right? And so how we see that show up can then dictate what interventions might be more helpful. But it is a little bit of a science experiment where we kind of have to test out and see how things go and see how things work for us. And that process can be really challenging to watch your loved one go through, especially if, like you said, maybe not everyone's been vocal about their BFRBs, but maybe you've grown up with something that was hard in a similar way and you don't want to see your child go through this similar pain. And so it can be really hard to sit through or work through these different behavioral experiments when your impulse, your urge, for lack of a better word, is to say,
yeah, you're absolutely right. And we see this so often, like when a child walks out of the bathroom and their eyelashes are gone and their eyes are all poofy and red. The parent, usually the first reaction is like, did you pull? And the child's first reaction's, nah. And again, normal, right? To have that reaction on both sides of it But that's where we have to be able to observe, look at what's working, look at what's not, and maybe we change our response. And maybe we say something a little bit later to the child or something too, to be like, oh, you know what? I think I noticed your BFRB tried to come up and get your attention earlier today. I wonder what it wanted. Do you have any ideas about that? And that's where we take this curious, compassionate approach to things in this scientific method. And as parents, there's a lot of things that we can do to help our child. Understanding, Marla was talking a little bit earlier about those vulnerability factors. There's a lot of things that we can help our children with. I have a 12-year-old. She's going through this stage right now with her sleep where she wants to stay up till midnight. We went through this last night getting ready for school today. And just really cueing, like, okay, it's time to tune in. Let's calm down in another way. And I noticed her wanting to look at screens. Every time I looked, she was on her phone. And so it was something to just say, you know, stop doing the phone or stop picking or stop doing, you know, whatever the stop behavior is that we want our child to do. To realize that that doesn't really work. What are they trying to accomplish? I know for my child last night, she was just trying to shut off her brain, right? So, and that isn't the best way to do it. So instead, what we did is we filled up her sink full of water and put like a little glow cube in there. And we had a little laser light show in her bathroom before bed. And that was so calming for her. It really helped her to shut down her day. And so when we can look at that with curiosity and compassion, maybe we can offer another alternative to that behavior that we find to be undesirable, or the child may or may not find to be undesirable. But we want to look at those factors, sleep, you know, looking to see, is our child eating breakfast before they go to school during the day? Are they moving and grooving their body? If they're a child on the spectrum or with some type of neurodivergence, we want to be able to wiggle. We all do, right? So what are their comorbidities that we have? And comorbidity, co-occurring conditions, tend to frequently occur with BFRBs. They're not always there, but they're often there. So we want to make sure that we're attending to those things, attending to our body's needs, attending to our mental health needs. And if we're just built a little bit more sensitive, that's okay. So we just need more surfing lessons to know how to surf those. And to Marla's point too, we can't fix those things for our kids or to stop them. Like, don't feel that way, right? Stop crying. Or, you know, it's being able to understand our child for how they're built. And it's going to take them a little time to learn these skills. Just like we didn't just snap into it. And sometimes we never learn it. Thing that we really want to cultivate that curiosity, that compassion, and that focus on, let's get your needs met through skills. And once we know kind of your areas, your communication that your BFRB is trying to say, then we can target those skills that much more. So we're not throwing everything in the kitchen sink at our kids or ourselves, but we're really tailoring a treatment plan for where we are right now in our experience.
Yeah. I was just thinking, my daughter, my youngest, has a BFRB, and it kind of shapeshifts because sometimes it'll be more of a picking at maybe some fine hairs or whatnot. Sometimes it might be cheek chewing. But what I've noticed, she's also autistic and she has ADHD. And we used to be in a mode where if she was at school and needed more of that assistance, she's on medication, because this would help her regulate so much more. And as time went on, we started to realize, actually, she benefits from having that more often because she engages a lot more in her BFRB when she's trying to rein in her brain that is just moving so fast in so many different directions. And wouldn't any of us feeling dysregulated try to reach on for some kind of guardrail somewhere, right? And so understanding that helped us to know, okay, actually it is more beneficial for her to have, whether she's going through the course of a school day or even just free play and a routine that we have here at home, because she is going to feel more of that frantic attempt to rein in her brain. And BFRB has been a strategy for her to be able to rein that in. And realizing that we can't just take away that strategy and expect her to have no guardrail. We do have to offer some other way for her to be able to feel a sense of regulation and soothing. And so between that and gymnastics, it was a huge win. It doesn't mean she never picks. And again, her brain is going to brain. So the objective isn't for her to not pick, but she doesn't do it nearly as much because she has all this really regulating proprioceptive input through her gymnastics, her vestibular input there too, and has the different medication that helps. This one example, and I'm not saying it has to be everybody's course, but we would notice, we would be like, oh my gosh, she'd wake up with the chapped from the lip licking, or, you know, just depends on which BFRB flavor was going on for her at the time. And so it's one of many examples, and it doesn't mean that I'm better than anyone. Trust me, it was hard as a parent to be like, I knew what BFRB was at that point. And I was like, there isn't stopping it. How do I stop eating? How do I stop breathing? How do I stop? No. How do I stop regulating? We want our kids to be able to regulate. This is a strategy for regulation. So it's about finding that balance of tools. And guess what? Sometimes that balance for her is going to be picking. It's going to be lip licking. It is. It just is. Whether she had access to the tools or not, that might be what she picks. Just like I might pick some Ben and Jerry's. So having a therapist there takes some of the pressure off parents and kiddos, because the therapists, especially one that is trained to treat BFRBs, can help be the guide of those behavioral experiments, can help be the guide of understanding the map and understanding the times and the different stair steps of that treatment process. But sometimes, do you ever get into a scenario where you suggest for parents too to go, you know what, like, this has been hard. It's been a lot of stress for you. Parenting in and of itself is hard enough. Maybe even having your own support for managing these stressors might be really, really beneficial.
Absolutely. Yes. In BFRBs, but also in other presentations also, right? We see this sometimes in OCD or other kinds of anxiety disorders. Sometimes parents need to, in the airplanes kind of analogy, right? Sometimes when the masks drop, it's important for parents to focus on putting their own mask on first, so that they're able to be effective in helping the child with their mask, right? Sometimes parents need those skills too. So it's important sometimes to say, okay, I see this as sort of a difficulty that the parent is having, right? To implement the recommendations, for example, of being able to take a step back, being able to watch your kid feel anxious or engage in these behaviors sometimes, right, without intervening. And sometimes it's helpful to parents to have their own space to learn to kind of sit with their own discomfort and develop their own set of skills, right? When you were talking, Nicole, about the parallel process, I mean, sometimes we feel ourselves kind of pulled into doing some family therapy almost because we see some problematic interaction patterns. Like if a parent has difficulty not yelling at their kid, stop doing this, why are you doing this to yourself, right? If they're driven by their own distress and their own emotion and their own fear that their child is going to be hurt or suffer in some way as a result, perhaps the parent needs some skills. Maybe not just the child learn to effectively communicate, this isn't helpful to me. So the child may need some communication skills training and personal effectiveness training. But the parent might also need some emotion regulation skills themselves. I was thinking in that scenario, like, teaching parents from DBT opposite action. When you feel this particular kind of action urge and you see that in the past, the chain of events doesn't go in a way that actually meets your goal, you might actually have to decide on some behaviors that are the opposite of what you feel the urge to do in order to get a different outcome. It's not that you're not trying hard enough. You might not be trying the right things, right? So instead of yelling at your child, you might instead say, I can see you're really struggling with this, and I'm really sorry this is hard for you. No, you can't handle these big feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, family, again, parents are working so hard. And so if you add any kind of special circumstance or special need into the parenting relationship, it can feel really overwhelming. And so if anyone is sitting there listening going, so it's me, I'm the problem. No. It's not about you or your kid being the problem. The problem is life is tough and there's going to be things we need to regulate through. And we all are doing our best to regulate through. And for a lot of people, BFRBs, a manifestation, people are still trying their best, even if it's causing distress and interrupting functioning in life. But it doesn't mean that we can't benefit from support, help in resources. And for parenting, what is that old adage? It takes a village. Why is the old adage not, it takes one person. You should be able to do this uniformly on your own. Otherwise, it's weakness. No, it's a village. But we stop.
we start feeling so responsible that we have to make sure our kid is successful for this and this and this and this, and we forget the village. And so all of this is to say, this is not a blame game for anybody, for your kid, for you. This is, it takes a village. So where's your village at? Okay. We need to do a village call and be like, where are my people at? And if you are standing there going, it's just me and the kid and the skin picking, it's not a village. And so a village can look many different ways. It can be making mom friends. I once saw a really funny meme. It was around, I don't remember, I think it was maybe around Easter time. And it said, you know, nobody ever talks about the real miracle being that Jesus had 12 friends in his 30s. And it's like, yeah, I mean, the older you get, it is harder to maintain some of those relationships and friendships, mom villages, through different periods of life. For younger kiddos, there's mommy and me groups sometimes and things like that. But especially, or through sports, maybe you get to know a few other parents, but life gets really busy. Work gets busy, especially if you have multiple people doing multiple things in multiple directions, right? And so do you have a village? And it's okay. Your village may not be a therapist, but a therapist can absolutely be part of your village and helping guide through that process. So that you can go, okay, it's not I'm a mistake and I'm at fault here, or my kid's a mistake and they're at fault here. We're all just trying to regulate through life, which is tough and it's tricky, right? And so I think that's a really helpful reminder. Any other things we would say on the kid front? Because I kind of want to think too about the partner front. It is a whole different bowl of wax there when we're trying to speak to another adult. But anything else you guys would want to say for parenting struggles around this particularly?
Well, I think, Nicole, to your point, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that it's not our job as parents to control the behavior. Our job is to love our child and to give them the opportunities to care for their mind, care for their bodies. We're not going to know everything, right? I bring my child to a dentist because I'm not a dentist. So when we've reached our limit of knowledge, or even maybe I know these things, but my child hears it differently from somebody else.
Uh-huh.
So it's being able to find that village. And there are support groups and things like that. Picking Me is a great resource. BFRB Changemakers. There's online like social network groups like Tricky Picky Parenting. There's a lot of great things that parents can reach out to talk to other parents going through a similar journey. And to remember that there's so many other aspects that make up your child. This is just one little sliver of the totality that makes up who they are. So we don't want to hyper-focus so much on what their skin, nails, or hair looks like, because there's so many other aspects that make up that child. And by over-focusing on a behavior, sometimes we make the behavior occur more often. We inadvertently end up reinforcing those things rather than extinguishing those behaviors, or just having less focus on them and focusing on what matters most to that child, to our family system.
Yeah, great point. Anything else you would add to that, Marla?
No, I think that was so well put. I think that's the case. And that's one of the things that we try to do in treatment, even with adults, is to try to kind of broaden the lens, right? When a behavior is really bothering us, whether it's ours or whether it's our child's, you know, we tend to sort of break out the magnifying glass. You know, we forget to take a step back. There's so many wonderful things about us and about our children that we kind of lose sight, right, of the forest for the trees. And it's important to take a step back and focus on the big picture of how wonderful we are as people, despite our little struggles.
Yeah, I mean, for any of us, if we were to think of something that pulls at our heartstrings or triggers our insecurity, would we want to focus on that, what feels like 110%, and just be like, but this thing here, but this thing here? I mean, that's not all of who we are. It is a struggle amongst an expanse of so many things that make up who we are. And so part of it is, yes, just even that process of, it's so huge for breaking down the shame too, of going, oh my gosh, this is like one of so many things about me. And while it's important, it's causing me distress, I want to feel some better sense of regulation and control over this. Also, it's not all of me. And that is super important. So well said, ladies. So as we move into adults, and like you said, it's similar, but it's different because
One of you just mentioned how our kids don't always hear things from us the same way they might hear it from a complete stranger. Well, that can go for our partners, our spouses. I'm guilty of this too, so I'm not just like pooping on my partner here, but I'm guilty of this too. Sometimes I could hear things a little more clearly from somebody that's not as subjectively involved, or adult siblings, different people in our life. And so when we think about, as a family member or a loved one, trying to support our person with a BFRB, and maybe they're feeling distress about it, but they're also maybe for shame reasons, maybe not seeing that it is a helpful option, been dealing with this my whole life, hasn't gotten better, what hope is there for me? Like, how can family members and loved ones help support their loved ones struggling with their BFRB?
This is part of that individualized treatment plan, because that's going to look different for each family. And some family members, even with the best intentions, may at the end of the day still not be the best person to go to for this kind of support. Maybe they're a great person to go to for something else, but maybe not your person for this, because it's too hard for them not to over control the situation. And so it's really understanding, as the individual with the BFRB, what do you need from other people and what don't you need from other people? And this is that interpersonal component that Marla and I built into the integrative treatment model, finding ways to recognize that within ourselves. And also, you know, kind of with family, to be able to set boundaries, to be assertive. So all these interpersonal effectiveness skills that are so important. And sometimes, again, no matter how hard we try with somebody, this might not be their thing. And that's okay. So it's finding those support networks, finding what we need to help us do that detective work, right? So to look at, okay, what is my body telling me? And what are the skills that I need? And that's part of that functional behavioral analysis that a therapist works on with somebody, or should be working on with somebody, to be able to identify those antecedents. Look at the specifics of the behavior, the searching, like how the behavior starts, what happens during the behavior. So when people pull out their hair, are they biting off the bulb? Are they stroking on lips? Are they biting their nail and flicking it? Like what, when they pick their skin, what happens next? Do they get something out and stick it to the mirror? Do they touch it to their skin someplace else? Do they smell it? So we gather all of this data, and then we look at the consequences, antecedents, behavior, consequences, short-term and long-term. Sometimes when, especially early on in treatment, we don't always have that awareness. So sometimes we can ask our spouse, hey, you know what? Like, I really am not always aware of when I'm picking my skin or biting my nails. So when you notice me do that, you know, help me do this detective work. And maybe you're just like, oh, honey, I noticed that your BFRB is showing up right now. Oh, yeah, I'm really tired. Or, you know what? I think I'm hungry. Or, oh, yeah, I had a really tough day at work. Because then they can maybe cue us to do that self-observation, or they can give us insight. Like, do you know that you do this as you're falling asleep at night, right? So some people do engage in their BFRB while they're sleeping. So sometimes that's where a partner can be helpful if asked. Yeah. And in a gentle, loving, curious, compassionate type of way, partners and other family members can be helpful.
Yeah. In talking about BFRBs in the past, and I'm thinking most recently I had a sensory panel where Dr. Lisa Conway was sharing, and we were talking about the difference between curiosity and capability. Capability is a word that irritates me, because people are capable of not picking, people are capable of not compulsing, people are capable of all sorts of things, right? I'm capable of running a marathon. I can't run a marathon every day. And so not getting stuck in, you're capable in one setting to not do this, so you should just not do it, because obviously you can, you're capable of not doing it. And being curious instead, really exchanging those C's and going, okay, why is this showing up now? I've also noticed at times, sometimes partners will engage in BFRB behaviors on each other. And this can kind of become a cuddle puddle of struggle. And so sometimes maybe one has the BFRB, maybe the other one just is like, I don't care, you sure go to town, whatever. It can be satisfying for the one. But usually, generally, if you're letting somebody kind of engage in that behavior, you're not completely adverse to it. And so in that scenario, maybe one person is starting to recognize or wanting to deal with their distress. Maybe the other person isn't aware of what they get out of their participation in that. Have you guys come across that? And how, and they're like, yes, great, they're like, yep. And how do you help address that when there really is, because that this has become then a way of them connecting. And so realizing there are other ways to connect, but helping them build that self-awareness and insight even to how that's functioning for them.
Absolutely. And we see this between parents and kids too, but the partnership, the relationship is different. And so between a parent and a child, the parent's role, part of their job, is to help shape the child's behavior and teach them things. That's the role of the parent. But it's not in the same way. The relationship is not like that for a partnership, right? So it's a little bit different if it's a relationship between siblings, depending, or a relationship between spouses or other kinds of partners. So it's important to kind of look at that. What function is the behavior playing in the relationship? How is the behavior affecting the relationship? And also, how's the relationship affecting the behavior, right? Because there might be something happening that is unintentionally perpetuating the behavior. And so we need to look at that. Perhaps a partner has difficulty sitting with their partner's discomfort, or perhaps it is satisfying in some way for them to help them in this way and help them feel soothed, to bring a little bit of humor into the moment. It's like, I don't know if you've seen those memes of like, picture the dishwasher, and it's saying there's always one person in the relationship who goes and rearranges the dishes. And maybe that's helpful in some ways, but also maybe it's problematic in others. It doesn't allow the other person to develop the skills and self-efficacy, really, to be able to develop their own way of managing the behavior. So in some ways, it kind of looks like a little bit of couples therapy sometime. You have to kind of look at the way in which this behavior is playing out in the relationship, and look at the roles that each person serves within this context. Look at the rules and limits and boundaries that they set for one another, and kind of evaluate, is this working for you? Is it not working for you? Because there is no right and wrong. We all have very different kinds of relationships, and that's fine. But if it's not serving us well, if it's not helping us become happier in our relationships with our loved ones or personally, right? If it's contributing to harm or suffering, then that's problematic. And perhaps we have to work on interpersonal effectiveness skills or figure out other ways to kind of meet those functions in a way that feels good and satisfying for both people.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And it just kind of takes me back to where we started this conversation and talking about the importance of flexibility, right, in terms of how we approach, because so often we can go, this is the one way this thing needs to function. Or that's what we've learned, and this is going to be effective for me. And there's not enough time in the day, so we're going to stick with what we know. It's not broken. But here in this scenario, there is something that is getting to this distressing level, and that's not serving you in the way. So is it not broken? Well, it's functioning, but not functioning in a way that is aiding you help. It may be giving that very temporary sense of help or regulation in the moment, but it's also leading to this cascade of shame and distress or dysfunction even in certain settings. And so recognizing, well, there is actually more than one way to be able to address this, and not in a shaming way, but in a understanding way. And so where it might come in and feel like couples counseling, that flexibility and realizing, I really like to serve you and feel like I've been able to satisfy you or bring you some regulation, some soothing. And there's more than one way I can do that. And realizing that I really liked feeling like I bring you joy in this way, but this wasn't helping you. Or maybe it's not even helping me. Maybe I have the same crap. And we're all just feeding off of each other. And are there other ways that we can serve each other that aren't going to feel like we're doing this backslide after the fact? And so, yeah, just being, again, curious together and working on some of that flexibility together is huge.
Absolutely. And I think doing the self-awareness training, being able to monitor behavior, writing things down, when are we noticing this behavior? What are all the things behind it? And then once we have that data, once we've just kind of paused and we really look at what's working, what's not, then we can start to really introduce skills. And that's where, with the integrative treatment model, we really start to get into the times map. Once we've done that functional behavioral analysis, we have people observed. What have they done in the past? Because like Marla said, it isn't that you haven't tried, right? People have tried really hard oftentimes to change this behavior on their own. And they're presenting to treatment because what they've tried, it just isn't quite working. And so we need to pause for a minute. We need to observe. We need to be good scientists, good detectives, to look at all of that in a non-judgmental way. Form a different relationship with our BFRB because they do tend to be chronic conditions. Learn how to observe. Learn what we need, what we don't need from other people. And really, and that's part of the map, the people, places, and spaces. And really, with step one of MAP, looking at movement and automaticity. And so practicing mindfulness skills, practicing that self-awareness, you know, really looking at what we need to do. If we're at a point in our change process where we want to work on this BFRB, which is, again, awareness training in and of itself, how ready am I? That's where we can start to look at those vulnerability factors. And maybe with my spouse, if I know that sleep is an antecedent or lack of sleep is an antecedent to my BFRB, that's where my partner and I can work together to be like, hey, let's go to bed at 10 o'clock, right? So like, let's not stay up and binge watch Netflix till 1 a.m. when I have to be to work by, you know, and start getting ready at 7. So these are ways that we can work with our family system to create these changes. Or let's make a point of making a healthy dinner together, or giving up time for breakfast in the morning. Or this is where, again, we can come together as a village to really identify what are the contributing variables to my BFRB, to my child's BFRB, and how do we start to address these things? Again, starting with awareness of what's going on in the first place, starting to introduce these different strategies. So being aware that when I put my hand up on the edge of the couch watching the movie, that might be a time where my BFRB shows up. That's a body posture that maybe makes it more aware. So maybe as a family, my seat is in the middle of the sofa, right? Rather than the end of the sofa where I can't prop my arm up. That's an example of movement. The A of MAP is the awareness of vulnerabilities, like the sleep, exercise, nutrition, taking care of those co-occurring mental health conditions or being more sensitive, and also medical conditions. If I have psoriasis, if I have itchy scalp that leads to picking behaviors or pulling behaviors, those things need attention too. And that also is part of the village. Having a dermatologist, having a wound care specialist, you know, other people make up our village. And that's part of the people, places, and spaces. And there's so many different things to consider, even with the MAP on our times MAP integrative model. That's where ourselves, we have to be the first person. So to really care for ourselves and learn how to identify our own needs and learn the strategies that we need. But certainly we can have helpers along the way with that, with parents, with spouses. So there's a lot of potential there for effective change.
Yeah, I was guilty as charged on staying up too late. As a parent that is like, oh, now it's my time, and then way like overindulging. It's kind of an analogy for the BFRB, right? Like, I know I need more sleep. I'm staying up too late because this is the time of day and I'm getting my need met here, but then it has this effect on me. I can be a grouch if I didn't get enough sleep. And so we can see like how just common this dynamic can be. And so having these tools and learning more about these things that seemingly you might think, oh gosh, my position on the couch, I wouldn't have thought had anything to do with this. And then realizing, oh, it could actually. I mean, I'm starting to understand, or the fact that I now have a wardrobe full of baggy sweatshirts. I'm thinking of the teens out there that are like, it's 95 degrees and they're in a sweatshirt. Aren't you hot? But you start to think about, oh, how do some of these things cover up if I am engaging in some of these picking behaviors? For other people, that might actually be a behavior blocker. I have my arms covered and I don't see it out of sight, out of mind. And so we start just even learning about all of these different aspects are really, really important. And I think validating too, for people to understand how their brain is, why are things occurring the way they are? I mean, knowledge is power there.
Yeah.
I'm getting the nods, y'all. So let's talk about the BFRB recovery workbook. I have a link to Amazon where you guys can pick up your copy as well. But you guys wrote this book together, and I think it's so helpful, not all workbooks are created equal out there. And so would love for you guys to share a little bit about how this came together and anything else that you would want people to know about that could be really helpful for them.
So this book was a long time coming. We felt after the hundreds of patients, maybe even thousands at this point, that we've collectively seen with BFRBs, we really felt like there were pieces missing in BFRB treatment, like addressing interpersonal factors, addressing emotion regulation skills. These are not typically part of BFRB treatment, but it also, in our experience, it seemed to be, for many people, the key to helping them in sustaining relief from their symptoms. And so we had been talking about it for a long time, and we decided that we wanted to bring some of our experiences and what we've been finding to be effective to people. So it's written really primarily for sufferers. It's a way for an individual who may or may not have access to a treatment specialist in BFRBs to be able to work through this treatment model on their own. It's sort of self-helpish in the way that it's presented. But we also secondarily wanted it to be a useful tool for therapists. So there are lots of different worksheets and things that therapists can use in their work with individuals with BFRBs to sort of help them along in being able to carry out effective treatment for folks.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point. And I can say as a therapist myself, it is so useful to be able to have a tool where with informed consent can let the client know, I am learning about this, but this is going to be a really helpful guide. And then in the process, you learn more about it, but also can provide some of that accountability and support then to your client. And so just having a tool available, and I think I may have reached out sometime in the past and had said, would this work for a teen? And you were like, depending on the teen, yes, I think it could work on a teen. And I can say, family, I have worked through this book with a teen where it was very, very helpful. But can you talk about, in terms of maybe understanding level, where this could be helpful? Teenage and beyond?
Yeah, I think that the book is targeted toward older teenagers, I would say, adults, therapists, family members, to really form that understanding of a BFRB and to approach the BFRB in a different way. It's ultimately living your best life with your BFRB, learning some skills along the way that are probably going to help to, one, just live an awesome life, but two, as a consequence of that, your BFRB is probably going to show up less. And so that's kind of the overall tone of the book. And it is absolutely full of skills. So we go into lots of detail. So like even example of sleep, for instance, we give like pages of ideas on how you can improve your sleep hygiene, emotional regulation strategies. We go into a lot of detail about skills and strategies that might be helpful to surf emotions, identify emotions. So we have a feelings wheel in there. There's distress tolerance, interpersonal skills, shame. We've really tried to give people practical skills that they could work on. So especially because most people do not have access to a BFRB specialist, we were trying to almost like take what we do in therapy as much as we can and put it into a workbook. And the worksheets are available too. We made those accessible for free for people through our publisher, Jessica Kingsley. So you can take a look at that. If you just look up BFRB recovery workbook, there is a little link to those resources available through the book as well. And of course, all the worksheets and everything are in the book too. So just to really help people work through this times map, as it's called, identifying thoughts, learning strategies to sit with or diffuse from those thoughts, to sometimes challenge thoughts. So we take what's out there, all of the empirically validated treatments, and try to put it into a user-friendly place, integrating all of this wisdom, all of this knowledge to help improve treatment outcomes. Because that was really the driving force, like Marla said. We've worked with so many people over the years and done so many trainings too for that point where we have therapists showing up, be like, yeah, I learned, you know, some of these older treatment models and work, right? It's not bad. But for some clients, they need more. And kind of the example that I use is some people come in and it's like building an IKEA bookshelf, right? Still probably a good idea to do the functional behavioral analysis and read the instructions. But certainly for people who have more rich lives and have had a lot of things happen or more sensitive nervous systems or comorbidity, we're not building a bookshelf anymore, right? We're building a house. And so we definitely need the blueprint. We need the skills in order to successfully build. And we got to do that on a solid foundation. And so that's really what we work through in this workbook with people, is develop that self-understanding. Look at your blueprint. Develop a healthy foundation. And then let's really cultivate all these fantastic skills that are out there for self-care in general. And as a result of that, your BFRB behavior is probably going to decrease. And even if it didn't, your life is still going to change. Your relationship with your BFRB is different. So where people understand it, they don't see it as the enemy anymore. So they don't see it as the self-destructive force, but they really look at their BFRB differently. And they're living their life differently in a more positive, in a more value-based type of way.
I love that analogy. And I'm thinking, it's been a hot minute since I built IKEA furniture, but I think it was like the Allen wrench or the L wrench or something back in the day. Could you imagine family trying to build a house with the Allen wrench? Essentially, what they're saying is, guess what? There's more tools than that. I think that's a great example. And so you guys wrote the book. I love that. I love that the worksheets are downloadable. So if you tend to like to read on your Kindle or this or that, or if you're the therapist trying to make photocopies and you're like, jimmying the book in there, this is a great way to be able to get access to some of those different resources. And so for adults, for some adolescents, this could be a very, very, very helpful resource. And I recommend, we have a lot of therapists and different researchers that listen to the show, I definitely recommend adding this to your collection because it is a very, very useful tool. We all have those books that are kind of like glorified paperweights. This is not one of them. This is one you can open up and you can put tabs in and refer to, and it's really helpful for therapists and the general population alike. So thank you both, and we look forward to continuing to learn more. But above all, family,
I hope you hear the hope.
In this, there's hope.
There's hope.
And even if it's defining the relationship in a new way with your BFRB, there can be a lot of hope in that. And so thank you again, and really appreciate both of you.
Thanks. Thank you for what you do. You really made the conversation very nice and easy and productive.
Well, thank you. I mean, fantastic guests. We're better together. Love it.
Intrusive thoughts.
Alrighty, fam.
All righty.
How great was that? I love that we were able to cover this really important, really common class of behaviors. And I love that we were able to think through them at both a pediatric and adult level. So another big thanks to Renee and Marla. They were both so warm and fantastic. And I'm sure you could pick up that they genuinely, genuinely care and want to support our BFRB warriors and their villages. So for today's intrusive thought segment, which for newer fam is the application segment of my show, I just want to think with you about how you can support learning more about BFRBs. And I'll note, as I've shared a few times already, all the links and info on where you can learn more about Marla or Renee, their work, their workbooks, trainings, additional resources will all be linked over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Because I know how we listen to podcasts, fam. I know. I do it too. So jump on over to the blog and you can check any of this out. But first and foremost, the BFRB Recovery Workbook. Again, it's a phenomenal resource, and I have no incentive to say so other than it's been extremely helpful, and I just want to be able to share that with you. I bought the book as soon as it came out, and it's continued to be a really phenomenal resource. Additionally, fam, another way we can do this is we can do a village recall. Who's in our circle? Are there ways to expand our support networks, whether we're the direct warrior, the bestie, the spouse? And then lastly, we can check out some of the resources or how to find a therapist for BFRBs. And honestly, I couldn't have said it better than our esteemed guests themselves. So let's take a listen to some of their favorite resources. If people are looking for a BFRB therapist, one resource I tend to kind of refer people to is BFRB.org, the TLC Foundation. But do you have any other resources, too, in which you refer people to find a provider?
There are a lot of fantastic resources now for people with BFRBs. For skin picking, I tend to refer people to Picking Me, which is fantastic. Lauren is the woman, the person in charge, founder of Picking Me. BFRB Changemakers is also an absolutely fantastic resource. Christina Pearson, who initially was the woman who founded TLC, now has another organization that is really, really fantastic. It integrates a little bit more like 12-step type of approach and just a lot of wisdom, a lot of compassion that goes along with that. So BFRB UK, there's resources outside of the US, UK, and Ireland. BFRB Mexico is a great resource. IOCDF, the International OCD Foundation, oftentimes will have trainings at BFRBs as well.
There's BFRB Canadian support too. So there's also a directory of Canadian therapists.
Just about every training that we give, the one that we gave this last weekend, I think there might have been someone from Australia. There's people from Mexico. There's usually people from Europe that do our 10-hour training. We do one-hour trainings, two-hour training, four-hour training, 10-hour trainings. Just get as much information as we can out there to people, because that's still one of the huge barriers is access to care. So we're trying to train other people and come up with creative solutions and also reaching a variety of different individuals who can benefit from those resources. So the challenge is to check out at least one of these resources, fam. And that might just mean downloading a worksheet about your map or working through your times. But regardless of where you're at, listening with us today, know that there's always hope in redefining or improving your relationships, whether it's with DFRBs, our own nervous systems, or even within our families. So take heart and hope, fam. And I'll look forward to hanging out with you again right here next week.
Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. Provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the down low on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Marla, Renee, and me discussing BFRBs. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.